Case on for today's northern panel, Harris versus State, case number 81430. Appellant is Mr. Halen. Do you want to introduce your co-counsel?
Yes.
For the record?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joshua Halen. This is my co-counsel, Matthew Hippler. I will be doing the argument this morning.
Would you like any time left for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I would request 3 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you. All right. Whenever you're ready to begin, please come up to the podium.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Joshua Halen, and I represent Plaintiff Appellant Anthony Harris in this case. The District Court's orders improperly barred Mr. Harris from even getting his lawsuit off the ground, committing legal and reversible error in doing so. Mr. Harris's civil rights complaint alleged an Eighth Amendment claim for deliberate indifference based on extreme chest pain that he had been suffering for 7 months, with no attention from medical or from prison staff, despite making them aware of the same. The District Court committed error in dismissing Warden Williams with prejudice at the first instance and in granting him qualified immunity. Further, the District Court erred in granting the state defendant's motion to dismiss based on NRCP 4E. Regarding the dismissal of Warden Williams, Harris's complaint provided Warden Williams with fair notice of his Eighth Amendment claim. An Eighth Amendment claim for deliberate indifference requires a plaintiff to allege both an objective and a subjective elements. The objective prong requires the plaintiff to allege that he or she has been denied serious, or that the plaintiff has suffered denial of their serious medical condition. Such a test is objective, and it's an issue of fact for the jury to determine. Indications of a serious medical condition are a condition that a reasonable doctor or a reasonable patient would find warrants attention. Other indications would be the condition interfering with the plaintiff's daily routine or daily life. It's important to remember that Nevada remains a notice pleading jurisdiction, and that federal courts consistently hold that pro se pleadings, especially civil rights complaints such as Mr. Harris's, are held to a less stringent standard, and that all benefits are resolved in the pro se's favor.
Mr. Halen, so the issue that was raised, or at least the primary one on which the court relied, was because Mr. Williams, other than being named as a party in the introductory portion of the complaint, didn't allege Warden Williams' specific involvement in the facts at issue. So doesn't the case law require at least to make an allegation about some personal involvement of the defendant?
I would agree that the case law does require an indication of involvement. But here, Harris alleged that Warden Williams, as well as the other defendants, were aware of his medical condition and failed to act. So given Nevada's notice pleading standards, as well as liberally construing Mr. Harris's complaint as a pro se litigant, that was sufficient, alleging that that Warden Williams knew about and failed to act. The district court's specific holding, or implied holding, I would say, that every single act, every single involvement of Warden Williams was required, is more than this court has required in other instances. Again, under the notice pleading standard, the standard is fair notice, and Harris provided that in his complaint. But even
in his opposition as well, would you state that he provided at least enough notice to show that Williams was aware of the violation or the conscious indifference of getting him his medical needs?
Absolutely, Your Honor. As you likely recall, in Harris's opposition to Warden Williams' motion to dismiss, Harris alleged that Warden Williams was aware of his medical condition via the first level grievance that he filed. As was pointed out in the opening brief, the NDOC regulations require that the warden review, investigate, and respond to the first level grievance. So, and it appears that the district court had even considered Mr. Harris's allegations on the grievance being filed and the first level grievance being filed, because that appears to be what the district court based its dismissal with prejudice on in granting Warden Williams qualified immunity. There was no allegation in the complaint on the grievance, and the district court held that Warden Williams was entitled to qualified immunity simply for responding to a grievance. That holding was an error. The Ninth Circuit and courts within the Ninth Circuit have consistently held that a defendant who's made aware of an ongoing medical condition via the grievance is not entitled to qualified immunity. And that standard makes sense. The Eighth Amendment subjective prong requires that the defendant have notice of the medical condition, and the grievance makes them on notice of that condition, and then their failure to act further satisfies the subjective element. But from a prison, from a penological purpose, depriving or not granting qualified immunity in such instances makes sense. Inmates are required to exhaust their administrative remedies before filing a civil rights complaint, which is the grievance process. If a and the grievance process and exhausting administrative remedies, the U.S. Supreme Court has said, you know, makes sense and serves important purposes, giving the prison an opportunity to correct a policy before it goes to federal court, or to providing the prison an opportunity to correct a mistake before it goes to federal court. If a defendant is entitled to qualified immunity in responding to an ongoing harm raised in a grievance, then the grievance process serves no purpose other than a procedural hurdle for inmates to clear before filing suit. Furthermore,
did Mr. Harris sufficiently request the opportunity to amend his pleading short of a dismissal?
Yes, Your Honor. Harris filed in his opposition to Warden Williams' motion to dismiss, he requested leave to amend and then included those factual allegations on both making Warden Williams aware of the situation via the grievance and then in having a conversation with Warden Williams before the suit was filed. After the district court granted Warden Williams' motion to dismiss and dismissed him with prejudice, Harris filed a motion for reconsideration, seeking that the with prejudice designation be removed and that it be dismissed without prejudice, and he further required leave to amend in this instance. So,
I have a question that's a bit unrelated to that, but you talk about the standard of review and stress that Nevada's different from federal, which it is. We have Buzz Stube and they have Iqbal Twombly, and we all understand that. But federal does have a pro se liberality case law that, as far as I can tell, Nevada doesn't have that. Did you find any Nevada published cases that say we construe pro se pleadings generously in favor of the pleader?
I did not, Your Honor, but it's a standard that makes, I believe, inherent sense, especially with the rise of pro se filings and legal costs getting more and more expensive. We're talking about defendant or plaintiffs who aren't trained lawyers and who are interpreting the rules of civil procedure as easy as they are for us to understand. It's a bit more difficult, I believe, for a pro se litigant. So it's a standard that hasn't been articulated by the Nevada Supreme Court, but it's a standard that also hasn't been rejected by the Nevada Supreme Court in a published or unpublished opinion that I'm aware of.
Could you address the service issues?
Absolutely, Your Honor. regarding the service issue, it's undisputed in this case that Harris served the state defendants via the Nevada Attorney General's office, thus satisfying the first of the dual service prong requirement in this state. Given the service of the Attorney General's office, the district court was required, under NRCP 4.2D6 to grant Harris additional time to complete service, and it erred in holding that it was bound by NRCP 4E's 120-day requirement. But even if the mandatory additional time wasn't required in the rules, Harris, in his opposition to the state defendant's motion to dismiss, requested additional time to complete service because he was under the belief that he had completed service, which, as was pointed out in both the opening brief and the reply brief, isn't unreasonable given that given that the Carson City Sheriff's Office had personally served the NDOC's administrative office. But even if that didn't, even if the additional time wasn't required, the district court clearly abused its discretion in not considering Harris's request for additional time and then failing to even identify the Scrimmer factors, or failing to analyze the Scrimmer factors that have been articulated by this court. The state defendants waited 6 months to file their motion to dismiss, 6 months after the Attorney General's office had been served, 3 months after the 120-day deadline for service to be complete, and 4 months after Mr. Harris had filed his notice stating that he believed that service had been completed on all of the defendants. So again, those factors, as well as Mr. Harris's pro se status, all weigh in favor of a finding that the district court clearly abused its discretion in dismissing the state defendants pursuant to NRCP 4E.
And this was filed after the new NRCP took effect in 2019?
Yes, Your Honor. So my recollection is that the new NRCP took effect March 1st, 2019. Mr. Harris filed his complaint in October of 2019, and then the dismissal orders, both of Warden Williams and of the state defendants, occurred in 2020. If my memory serves correctly, Warden Williams was dismissed in May of 2020, and the state defendants were dismissed in June of 2020. If the court has no further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Yes.
Thank you
so much. All right, we'll hear from respondent and Mr. Zanino.
Thank you, Justice Silver, Justice Pickering, Justice Kadish. I'm Greg Zanino, and I'm representing the respondents in this case, and in particular, Warden Brian Williams, who is the focal point of the appeal, as I understand it. And I would like to start by noting that a complaint, when it's scrutinized under Rule 12b-5 and Rule 8, typically falls into one of two categories, right? And these are categories that are kind of at opposite ends of the spectrum. The first type of complaint is a complaint that really contains no factual allegations at all. And Justice Candace, you made this point, is that the complaint itself in this case, the four corners of the complaint don't contain any factual allegations that pertain specifically to Warden Brian Williams. Warden Brian Williams is mentioned as a defendant, but the complaint doesn't kind of specify exactly what Warden Williams did wrong. And then at some point after the case was filed, the complaint was filed, the inmate offered an opposition to the motion to dismiss, and this appears at page 43 of the record, where he introduced this idea that he had made an informal complaint, a first-level complaint, and a second-level complaint, and he noted that Warden Williams had, in all probability, reviewed the first-level complaint, which I believe is accurate. I mean, that's an accurate description of the Department of Corrections grievance process. The problem for the inmate in this case is his own timeline that he lays out in his complaint. He says he filed the informal complaint in March, the first-level grievance in June, and the second-level grievance in July. And this is at pages 19 and 20 of the record. Mm-hmm. So all of this occurred within a relatively short period of time. by the inmate's own admission, he started to complain about chest pains in December of 2018. He complained on two subsequent occasions, and then he was taken to see a cardiologist in June of 2019.
Well, unsuccessfully, apparently.
Yeah, so there was a scheduling glitch, right? And I don't think there's any reason to attribute that scheduling glitch to Warden Williams, right? To me, it looks like the cardiologist was just booked up, right? And he came back in July, and he was still booked up, and he said, okay, come back in October. So I don't see any facts in the complaint to suggest that Brian Williams was responsible for these kind of hiccups that occurred. But I think what we can reasonably infer from the complaint is that Brian Williams possibly became aware of this situation in June, and Mr. Harris was transported to the cardiologist in June. So this doesn't support an inference of deliberate indifference. If anything, it supports the opposite inference. It supports an inference that Warden Williams acted promptly to get Mr. Harris medical attention.
Well, isn't that facts to be developed in discovery? Like, why should we be speculating about how that played out?
But I think that argument cuts the other way too. Is why should the defendants have to speculate about what what direction Mr. Harris's complaint might take via discovery? I mean, at a minimum, I think you have to put the defendants on notice as to what they did wrong, right? And we have no idea, based upon this complaint, that Warden Williams did anything wrong, right? That he did something inappropriate. There's no way to draw that inference.
Let me ask. But wouldn't you say in his opposition, by the time he rolls around to the opposition to dismiss, he is stating some types of facts about the warden knowing about this, or at least there's an inference that the warden knew about it, and that there was then a deliberate indifference not to get him his medical needs, which might very well survive a motion to dismiss, because if you take all of the facts in the light most favorable to him, it might very well pass muster, and then you go to summary judgment, what you're talking about, well, which would be later down the line, well, if that's true.
I think that the information that Harris introduced by way of his opposition to the motion to dismiss goes to the question of whether the district court abused his discretion in terms of not affording an opportunity to amend. I think initially the question is, does the complaint state a claim? Mm-hmm. It doesn't. I think the secondary question is, did the district court judge abuse his discretion in failing to give the plaintiff, inmate Harris, an opportunity to amend? And I would submit that he did not, again, because I go back to this timeline. Even if he had been afforded this opportunity, I mean, presumably what he would have said in his amended complaint is, I made a grievance. Warden Williams would have reviewed that grievance, and therefore he was deliberately indifferent to my medical condition. And there's no way that those allegations establish a claim of deliberate indifference, because deliberate indifference is a very high standard. I mean, it's higher than medical malpractice. It's higher than reckless, disregard.
But if you know of somebody's dire medical condition and you consciously know about it and you fail to act, that certainly meets a conscious indifference.
I think that's true, but the indifference typically is evidenced by a period of delay, right? And that's the common scenario where you have an omission to act, an omission to render aid or to make arrangements for a physician to evaluate the inmate, coupled with delay, right? And here there's no delay. By Harris's own admission, there was no delay that could support kind of an inference of deliberate indifference.
Well, I mean, how do we know that? I mean, there were some conditions where you might say you need to see a doctor today, not in 3 weeks, for example.
Well, I mean, I suppose that the emergency room would be a place for that kind of thing to occur, right? But there's
nothing. Mr. Harris doesn't exactly have access to the emergency room.
But I mean, if someone were having a heart attack in the prison, right?
Right.
If they're having a heart attack,
right,
I think the prisoner the prison officials have to find a way to get that person to the emergency room, right?
Right.
Not to a cardiologist, right? So,
right.
So the fact that they took him to a cardiologist, and the fact that Harris tells us nothing about his visit to the cardiologist indicates to me that there was nothing serious happening in June that required.
The cardiologist wanted to see him 30 days later, but he didn't actually see him until almost 90 days later.
Which I think is typical of trying to get in to see a cardiologist. I mean, I speak from personal experience. But that there's nothing about that scenario that indicates, one, that Harris was in need of immediate medical attention in June. And further, there's certainly nothing that suggests that Warden Williams was aware of the fact that Harris was in dire need of medical attention in June of 2019.
I kind of feel like I'm in federal court evaluating this under Iqbal and Twombly and plausibility. But we're in the we have different standards in state court. And it's you construe the complaint, as my colleague just mentioned, every allegation in favor of the plaintiff, blah, blah, blah. And it strikes me that on this complaint and this record, at minimum, there was enough to allow an amendment of the pleading as to Williams under Nevada's really generous Buzz Stew standard. Now, I asked your opposing colleague about the pro se liberality construction rule that obtains in federal court, and I don't know that I haven't seen a Nevada case that holds that as mandatory precedent. And it may just be that they have Iqbal Twombly and then a pro se standard, and we have Buzz Stew and nothing on the pro se standard. But either way, it strikes me he was having a dire symptom that would be terrifying to someone who is dependent on others for access to medical care. And it repeated and repeated, and it was not timely responded to, allegedly. I'm not saying down the road he can prove it.
So let me address Buzz Stew. I think Buzz Stew is often cited for the proposition that Nevada has a much lower standard, kind of a pleading standard than the federal courts. I don't think that Buzz Stew actually supports that proposition. I think what Buzz Stew says, and Buzz Stew begins with kind of a very firm statement. It says, this court will recognize all factual allegations and the complaint is true and draw all inferences in its favor. Buzz Stew's complaint should be dismissed only if it appears beyond a reasonable doubt that it could prove no set of facts which, if true, would entitle it to relief. And I focus on the facts, the words prove and true, right? This, I believe, speaks to the presumption of truth that's afforded to factual allegations. In other words, we presume that the factual allegations are true, but we don't necessarily fill in the holes with speculation. And I don't think that Buzz Stew tells us that that's what the court should do, is fill in kind of the void.
There's any set of facts that could have a valid claim for relief, right?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Sorry. The part that you were just reading from Buzz Stew talks about if there's any possible set of facts that could support a successful claim for relief.
I don't read it that way. I read it as saying that there's a presumption of truth. And then if you look at the facts in Buzz Stew, right, that it was a condemnation case. The city of North Las Vegas announced that it was going to condemn the property, or at least an acre of 20. And then at some point they decided that they didn't have the money to go through with the condemnation process. And they didn't tell the landowner. The landowner, in the meantime, sold the property and presumably sold it for less than market value because there was this kind of cloud hanging over it. And that, again, was a delay scenario where you had the city of Las Vegas kind of sitting on this information. And I think it was reasonable to infer, based upon the length of that delay, that there was some tortious conduct there.
But don't you see Buzz Stew? I don't think Buzz Stew's facts matter that much because it declares Nevada's continued allegiance to the pre-Iqbal Twombly interpretation of Rule 8, whether it's federal or state. The course change was Iqbal Twombly in federal court on pleading standards. Buzz Stew just says we're remaining faithful to any set of facts construed in favor of the plaintiff, and we've declared that allegiance, I know, in unpublished cases as well, on an ongoing basis.
I just don't see a significant difference between Iqbal and Twombly and the case law in Nevada, right? I think there's probably more area of agreement than there is disagreement between the Nevada Supreme Court and Iqbal Twombly. And I think Iqbal is an interesting case, right, because it has similar facts to this case. It was a situation where a detainee or the inmate went straight to the top of the chain of command. We're going to sue the Attorney General and the director of the FBI for the conditions that, these kind of deplorable conditions that existed within the prison facility or the detention facility. And this is a very similar in that regard, is inmate Harris went straight to the top. You know, we sued and this happens in many, many inmate cases, right? There's a tendency to want to sue the elected officials and the people at the top of the chain, right? So he sued the director and elected officials and the Secretary of State, and he included Brian Williams, who is also pretty high up in the chain of command. He's the warden of the prison, so he's one step below the director. And I think to make an allegation against the warden of a prison, you have to be fairly specific, because there is no vicarious liability, as I noted, and supervisory liability is limited. And Iqbal, the court in Iqbal pointed this out, is there isn't really just this notion that someone is liable because they're a supervisor. You have to, even if the named defendant is a supervisor over somebody that did something kind of egregious, you have to nonetheless show some kind of personal participation or knowledge.
I apologize. I appreciate that point, but I need to ask you about something else before time is up.
Okay.
Talk to me about service, and under Rule 4.2D, which has a specific extension provision in subpart 6 that wasn't cited to the district court.
So I agree that there was, you know, service upon the state of Nevada, and at that point, the judge, you know, knowing that, probably had an obligation to extend the time for service. But as I argued in my brief, that would have been futile, because there were no allegations against the persons that inmate Harris wanted to serve with the complaint. I mean, it was the same problem as Brian Williams. There were no allegations in the complaint.
There shouldn't be an extension of time to serve because of the merits?
No, I think it's harmless error, is my point. You know, under Rule 61, I think we're talking about harmless error. You know, this is a procedural issue, and that's governed by a harmless error standard. And I'll cede my time unless you have.
Do you have any more questions? Either no?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for your argument.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear again from appellant in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to briefly discuss the timeline that opposing counsel had brought up. Harris filed his first level grievance on June 7th of 2019, and it was denied on July 2nd of 2019. Between that gap, Harris had not seen a cardiologist. Harris was supposed to go to the cardiologist on June 12th, 2019, but prison officials didn't bring him until June 14th, 2019, and the cardiologist said, "You missed your opportunity, you missed your appointment, you're gonna have to come back." And Mr. Harris came back in July, I believe July 23rd of 2019. So during this time frame, even if you were to review the facts in this case, Mr. Harris had still not seen a cardiologist or any other medical professional by the time Warden Williams denied his first level grievance on July 2nd, 2019. But the other point that I would like to bring up is the point that Your Honor made regarding Iqbal and Twombly. Opposing counsel isn't advocating for an Iqbal and Twombly analysis. He's advocating for a motion for summary judgment standard or motion for summary judgment review in Mr. Harris's complaint. He's indicating that the district court should have weighed the facts and determined from the get-go whether Harris could have prevailed in his case, whether he had stated an Eighth Amendment claim. As this court had pointed out consistently, that's not the standard in reviewing a 12b-5 motion to dismiss. We look at the
courts are instructed to look at the allegations of the complaint, and a complaint should only be dismissed for failure to state a claim only if it appears beyond a doubt that the plaintiff could prove no set of facts, which, if true, would entitle him to relief. In this case, both looking at the complaint stating Harris's medical condition that he had not gotten attention for 7 months, as well as that each defendant was aware of his condition and failed to act, satisfies that standard. But even if it didn't, the proper remedy here would be for dismissal without prejudice, with leave to amend. There was no futility analysis by the district court. There was no consideration of those standards at all. Finally, regarding the service issue, 4.2d6 is explicit in its requirement that a district court must give additional time. And that requirement makes sense for this exact situation, so that when one of the two prongs have been required, that the defendants can't just wait and run out the clock to avoid service. The district court, if one of the prongs has been satisfied, is required to give additional time so that cases are decided on the merits.
Counsel's suggestion that we should look at that under a harmless error standard?
I think that that's a standard that hasn't been adopted by any court that I'm aware of. And, you know, this court's guidelines on clear abuse of discretion would accomplish that. But this futility analysis that a court would do in determining whether to provide additional time for service is just unsupported by any case law from this court. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, this case will stand submitted. I want to thank all of the counsel here. And
thank you for
being
on a pro bono appeal.
Yes, thank you for pro bono.